Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. We are going to take up today two bills that are so complicated that mere mortals cannot figure them out. So that's why we have Chris Allenack here to save the day. So let's start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 193. Chris, we've gone through this again. We need a greater perspective. And if you could also reference the dash threes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is the Interstate Broadcasters Bill. And so not focusing on the base bill, but the dash three, because that replaces the bill. The policy issue at stake is how interstate broadcasters are taxed in Oregon and how their income is apportioned to Oregon. And since 2014, there has been a policy that it is based on the customer domicile of the broadcasters. Prior to 2014, it was basically based on an audience factor. So that changed in 2014, and that policy was extended for 2 years in 2018. And so now it sunset at the end of 2018. The dash three extends it for 2 more years with the addition of requiring the Legislative Revenue Office in consultation with the Department of Revenue to put together a report and study the issue of interstate broadcasting taxation and make a recommendation to the legislature by December 1st, 2020, so that the legislature could take more definitive action in 2021 on how these entities would be taxed. You do have a fiscal statement and you do have a revenue impact statement. The revenue impact statement is an indeterminate, and if you'd like, I can go into that detail now, or we can leave that for a few minutes.
Maybe take a step back and tell us what the policy choices are in terms of how taxes are paid, how they're collected, and what audience we're looking at.
Okay, so up through 2013, interstate broadcasters, these are the companies that broadcast the TV shows, and the industry has been undergoing a lot of change in recent years. The way they would be taxed in Oregon would be you take their federal taxable income and the apportionment percentage, rather than being our single sales factor, so to speak, Oregon sales divided by US sales, it was based on an audience method. So an audience method, or if, so it would be basically for any broadcast, the share of the audience that was in Oregon compared to the US as opposed to sales. Oftentimes, if that information wasn't available, Department of Revenue would use a population factor as a substitute for this audience percentage. In 2014, the industry came forward and said and argued for a different policy, which would be the apportionment would be based on the domicile of their customers. The argument being is that the broadcasters are selling their airtime to certain companies, like for advertising and so forth, as opposed to the end viewer. And so as a test program in 2014, the legislature changed the apportionment method for 3 years, tax years 2014, 15, and 16, to this customer domicile approach away from the audience factor, and required LRO to study it to find out what the revenue impact was. The revenue impact initially in that 2014 session was a revenue gain of $1 million. The argument from the industry was that they were having various litigation in other states on how the taxation would occur, but switching to this domicile approach provided some certainty for them so that they'd be willing to pay a little more in tax. So that was the revenue gain of $1 million. Well, by the time that policy had ended, by the time we get through 2016, we tried to collect some information. And about the same time, there were audits that were coming out of the Department of Revenue on these broadcasters. And it became clear that there was disagreement about what the baseline tax policy is, what current law said about how these companies should be taxed. And those areas of uncertainty or the questions or the points of debate really fell along three lines. Which company was or was not an interstate broadcaster, whether or not they had nexus, and then how much of their income would be subject to apportionment. So when the legislature was faced with that decision in 2017, and as the court cases were moving forward, it was extended temporarily for 2 years to see if there'd be some resolution in the court system. And one company, Comcast, had a decision at the tax court, went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court mostly upheld the decisions, although they did remand the case back to the tax court to decide a couple of other outstanding questions. And given the difference of opinion between the Department of Revenue and the industry, that's where we have the challenge as to whether or not this is a revenue gain or revenue loss. And the audits that are at stake, there are a handful of companies for a number of tax years between 2006 and 2013. And when I've looked at the court case documents for these, there are about 18 different tax years. That's where I'm defining a tax year as a given company for a given year. So we have 4 to 5 companies in about 7 different tax years. The average tax in dispute is about $4 million, just taking all of that information to try and give the committee a sense of the dollars that are at stake here that are in dispute between these companies and the Department of Revenue. And in order to accurately make an estimate on the policy impact, we need some certainty as to what the baseline law is. And that's what's being debated out in the court.
Okay, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. Just for a point of clarification, $4 million in total or $4 million per on average?
$4 million per tax year. So the total number, you take that $4 million times the 18, and we're talking $70 to $75 million in tax.
Sorry, okay, makes more sense, yeah.
And there could be some penalty and interest there depending on payments. And these are just the cases that are public. I don't know for certain, but I believe there are other cases that there are other audits going on that are in the pipeline. They just haven't reached a public status yet.
Okay. Any other questions of Chris before we move in? All right. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, when you talked about the audience, there's an attempt, is there not, to look at the broadcast area, and if that's not available, then you default to the population of Oregon.
Yes, there are some administrative rules where if the audience factor for the actual viewership isn't available, then you can default to other measures, and population is one of those. But the policy goal would be for any given broadcast or show, what is the share Oregon viewers represent, what share of U.S. viewers. But that can be, I believe, challenging to get that exact information, so they default to other methods.
Correct. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And so if we focused on the income that's generated by the advertisers that the broadcasters sell to, the advertisers would be measuring, would they not, the size of the audience? In other words, isn't it normal for advertisers to follow up on who's receiving their message and so forth? And thus the amount of money coming back in is a reflection of the audience.
I believe that's the theoretical link, is that, and I'm not an expert in this area, but the value of selling the airtime can be tied to the expected viewership. If it's on a program that's nobody's expected to see, I'm not sure what the price of that. It shouldn't be very high. The best example is probably the advertising for the Super Bowl. There's a lot of information out there about what ad spots cost on the Super Bowl because of the viewership.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
And if there's what's called over-the-top sales, and so can you explain the difference? I'm not quite clear on how you manage the over-the-top sales when you're basing your tax on the advertisers.
And this points to a significant area of change in recent years within the industry. And the over-the-top is where you have a company who produces a show and they sell that directly to the viewer, where the viewer has an app. I think HBO Go is one, Amazon, Netflix, Hulu. Well, maybe not Hulu because there's the structure there. But basically, the company that's producing the show can sell directly to viewers, and it's not being sold to another entity that then broadcasts it or distributes the programming.
And if follow, Mr. Chair?
Senator Benz?
Yeah, so what I'm confused about is that the advertisers aren't buying the shows necessarily. They might just be selling advertising to the broadcaster. So where I was getting confused is, right there is where I'm getting confused. So maybe you can clear up that confusion.
Well, I think there might be people in the room who could speak a little more directly to that point on how the how that transaction takes place. I don't know to what extent if a company is selling a product and they buy advertising time, is it do they get to identify exactly which show and at what time, or if it's more broad than that? But I think there's some people in the room who might have a, be able to give you a better answer on that.
Senator
Benz.
So what we've identified, though, are three different sources of income. That's what I was trying to do. I was trying to break down the various sources of income. So you've got the overtop sales. There's no advertising there. You've got advertising, which the broadcaster might be selling directly to whoever. And then you've got the show itself being sold. So I was just trying to break down the streams of revenue coming into the broadcaster.
And I think that's kind of the idea around studying it. When the courts are looking at these cases, they have to work with their interpreting current statute. It's, the statute is rather old and existed before the current industry structure. And so the intent in the Dash 3, the study there, would be to take a fresh look at how they, to take into consideration all those factors and what would be the appropriate level of taxation.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Riley?
So I think we have to be careful. My understanding of advertising cost for the same number of viewers can be way different in different markets for the same number of viewers.
I believe so, and I don't mean to minimize or oversimplify how those transactions occur. I think there are people in the room who can give you better insight as to exactly how that works.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chairman Hess. Chris, looking at the screen up there, we did 2014 bill, we did 4138, and then I guess in 2017 we did 35, or SB 1523. If I recall correctly, we were indeterminate then because we didn't know either, right? So the indeterminate revenue statement has basically been persistently the same because we don't know what we don't know. And so therefore, if you're the state economist, we don't know what we don't know, and there's not a change. Is that sort of the correct?
That's an interesting way to put it, and I believe that's correct.
Okay.
And again, getting into the Dash 3, and the reason for a study is to end that cycle.
Exactly right, because one would assume, since if we did this for two more years, by that time we would have enough data, since we've been from 2014 forward, to be able to figure this out. Of course, assuming that we don't have androids and AI doing everything in 2 years and it's all changed again. But,
right, and I can go down and say, okay, if DOR is correct, this is the revenue impact. If industry is correct, this is the revenue impact. So that's where we come back down to who's correct. And,
right, exactly what we had before, yeah.
And I'm not in a position to say in, what's easy, I'm not in a position to forecast court decisions.
Right. Same problem we had the last two times.
Same problem, which is trying to come up with something different this time is the study in the Dash 3.
Yeah. Last time we had a public hearing on this, the Department of Revenue did not testify. I'd like you to weigh in here if you can, Deanna Mack.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 193, and I did have comments about the underlying bill itself, but it sounds like I might skip those because of the Dash 3 amendment. But I wanted to talk about some things that I've heard over the years that seem to be confusing for folks, and so I thought I would take the time to explain them. One, there's been this issue about nexus. And apportionment does not cause nexus. Nexus is a sufficient connection to Oregon, either physically or economically, that causes them to be subject to tax here. Once an entity has nexus here, then we apportion their income or divide it up amongst the states. So one does not, apportionment does not come before nexus. Nexus is established and then apportionment occurs. Another thing that we've talked about over the years is, and I hate to say these words, but Joyce and Finnegan.
Why did I know that was coming?
Joyce, Oregon is a Joyce state, not a Finnegan state, and that is a unitary principle and should not be conflated with Nexus. It doesn't turn, switching from Joyce to Finnegan is not going to turn on Nexus for anyone. It's also a principle that's applied to tangible personal property, not intangible property, which is what this bill is trying to address. Market-based sourcing, the shift to market-based sourcing is what addresses intangible taxation and aligns it to the sale of widgets, which has been destination. So that's just one issue that we've had confusion about over the years. Apportionment, generally, the smaller the numerator, the Oregon sales, the lower the tax liability. So the goal would be for tax planning is to lower that number. The numerator right now only reflects sales into Oregon. And Oregon, again, has given 100% weight to the Oregon sales since 2005. That's the reason why we've shifted from cost of performance to market-based sourcing. Market-based sourcing in most states that have adopted that method of sourcing, as well as the MTC model regulations that Oregon also adopted, identify the audience subscriber model of apportionment as the most appropriate way to source interstate broadcaster receipts. The trend of the states is to move to market-based sourcing and audience subscriber method. So at least 31 other states, I put a chart out here for you, use audience subscriber method of apportionment today exclusively. Five states use a hybrid of audience subscriber method with the commercial domicile method, some for advertising revenues only, some for broadcasting receipts for content, licensing of content. And then two states use the commercial domicile exclusively, and that's their sole source of apportionment, with one of those just beginning in January of 2018. 13 states, as you can see, still appear to be using cost of performance and haven't yet moved to market-based sourcing. What we've learned over the last several years is that through the litigation that we have going is that the contracts for licensing and content distribution are all based on viewers. They're all based on where people are watching. Fees paid for advertising are also based on viewers, like Chris talked about the Super Bowl. You can compare that to a midnight infomercial. They're wildly different. Also, we are, just to bring you up to speed, we are also auditing returns that are filing under commercial domicile. We've moved on from some of those, although they are still in the tax court, the audience method. And the results we have been finding are mixed. Some taxpayers are getting refunds. To give you some examples, we did a comparison a year over year from audience method to the commercial domicile method for several audits that we've done. And these are anonymized, so we don't know who the taxpayers are. But one taxpayer went from $6 million in tax in 1 year under audience method to $1 million in tax for under the commercial domicile, so a $5 million difference. Another went from $300,000 down to zero. Another went from $10 million down to $9.5 million, so it's a smaller amount. And then I have some other examples as well. What we've learned also in the audits under commercial domicile is that many of the companies that are hiring these advertisers, those advertisers are based in other states such as New York, and the receipts are being sourced to those other states, not Oregon. In fact, most of the receipts under commercial domicile, the reason that we haven't had any real disputes under that is because we aren't issuing deficiencies. So there's really nothing to appeal so far in those cases. That's why it's not being litigated. Sales to source to Oregon under the are under the commercial domicile method are much lower than they are under the audience method, which then in turn reduces the Oregon percentage that they apply towards taxable income. So under the audience method of apportionment, some of the companies have argued that they don't have nexus in Oregon. Some of the companies have argued that they aren't interstate broadcasters, which is what Chris mentioned. But we do believe that most of these companies do have constitutional nexus here, that they are actually, you know, they've got crews going up and down football fields filming to broadcast, for example. They've got logos in places. So that's one of the issues that has been, we've have talked about over the years. And another thing that we've talked about over the years is that we default to a population base on whether taxpayers, that we ignore the ratings that they provide or the audience that they provide. And that is not what our administrative rule says. We actually allow them to use sources such as Arbitron or Nielsen or any other comparable resource, as long as they're using it consistently. There's a publication out there that we allow them to use. They just need to use it consistently year over year. And then if there's no other method of apportionment, then we look to a default of a population. But we prefer that they provide us the information they have in their records when we're going through these audits. But we certainly don't disregard the ratings that they provide to us. So as far as the underlying bill itself, we had concerns if that were to move relating to some of the definitions in there, but I won't necessarily go over those if you don't have, if that's not what your intent is to do today. But I just wanted to give you that background on kind of where we stand on what we, our thoughts are and our experience over the last several years since we've been working on this issue. If you have any questions or would like me to go over the details of the introduced version, I'm happy to do that.
Chair, so I was looking at your report from 2017, or actually I think it was the office's report, and I was looking at the fact that there were, at that time, three issues. There's a lack of clarity regarding who's a broadcaster, mm-hmm. and this is going back to 2 years, the nexus, and which revenues are subject to apportionment. Has any of that changed? Are those three issues still issues?
And Senator Bence, yes, in the Comcast case, they argued that they were not an interstate broadcaster, and the tax court ruled that they were. They did not appeal that to the states, to the Supreme Court. So that issue has been resolved. Most of these folks are operating in the same way. Although it is possible, we think it's highly unlikely that the tax court or the Supreme Court would rule differently in those cases. But of course, like Chris said, it's the tax court. They get to make the decision, not us. The other issue you said was nexus. I think that other entities are still arguing that in court. That was not an argument made by Comcast. They didn't make that argument. And what was your last one? I'm sorry, Senator.
Which revenues are subject to apportionment?
Which revenues are subject to apportionment? That is what was Chair Haas and Senator Bence. That is the issue that went back on remand from the Supreme Court. The tax court ruled that under the way the statute is currently written, that and this bill doesn't address this issue. This is, I think, the third issue that when Viacom was talking, they said it was kind of something the court did on its own, as far as I know. But the issue is the statute says that once you're an interstate broadcaster, all your receipts go to being considered for Oregon purposes. And that is what Comcast appealed to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court affirmed the tax court's decision in that. But that is not a related, that I think would need a separate bill to fix if you wanted to do that.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Right, my question is, I'm trying to find out what still is unresolved, what still needs to be studied. Have all issues been resolved and thus there's no reason to delay in doing something, or is there a reason to wait? At least, there's lots of reasons to wait, but is there a reason to wait because of court proceedings?
Chair Haas, Senator Bence, I think that our opinion is that things have been resolved, but again, it is in the tax court's hands, so they may ultimately do something different if the taxpayer's facts are different. It doesn't seem likely, but it is possible. We think that things have been resolved enough that we can proceed. All of those cases that Chris mentioned were held in abeyance, and now they're being worked now that the Supreme Court has ruled.
How many cases?
It was 18 tax years. It was 4 to 6 companies with a variety of tax years that were at the public level.
Still ongoing.
Chair Haas, there are still some cases, yes, in the court system, correct. They are arguing that they aren't an interstate broadcaster, I believe. And I think they are, some of them are also arguing that they don't have nexus here in the state. So those are pending issues. But of course, the Supreme Court case and the tax court case, the prior court case will provide guidance.
So the third issue that was, that is reflected in the memo from 017 reads, which revenues are subject to apportionment. So what is your position on that?
Chair Haas and Senator Bentz, right now, the way the statute is written, it's all gross receipts. So I don't disagree with the court system. We agree with them.
Okay. Well, I don't know what the court said, so you'll have to forgive me. You know, so does that mean that the court said the answer was it's that which the broadcasters wanted, or is it the audience? Or do we have our choice?
Chair Haas and Senator Bentz, that is not the issue that was decided that you're talking about, the third issue. Apportionment, whether it's audience or commercial domicile, is the law as of that year. That isn't the issue. Those are both valid methods of apportioning income to Oregon. Just one has they have different revenue impacts. So the issue is the statute, and I can't remember the name, the actual statute that says that the once you are an interstate broadcaster, then all your receipts get sourced to Oregon. And so what's being remanded to the tax court in Comcast is whether their business income includes their capital gains and losses, their dividends, their non-unitary pass-through income, that kind of stuff. That is not relevant to whether apportionment should be done by audience or commercial domicile. It's about what income is in there. And then they're also arguing that if that stuff is business income, my understanding is that it needs denominator representation. So none of those issues, in my opinion, weigh on this issue of whether which method of apportionment you want to choose as your policy. Either one of them are valid policies. One has a different, they just have different revenue outcomes.
So what we're trying to get at is what is the most appropriate measure of the income of the corporation in this state. So in your opinion, which is better? Or does it depend upon the company?
Senator, or Chair Haas and Senator Bentz, it depends on what this body's goals are, if it's to give a tax break or not. Then either one of them we can administer. I know you guys probably don't like it when I say that, but they're both administrable. They just have different outcomes for the taxpayer. So it would be in line with whatever policy goals you have.
Well, Mr. Chair, let's assume that my policy goal is to have the fairest approach possible reflective of the income generated in this state by the sales of the corporation. Which one would better fit my policy goal as I just stated it?
Chair Haas and Senator Bentz, I know you've worked with Representative Barnhart for years on that revenue committee, and you know that he has that but-for test. But for Oregon, would there be any receipts or any income? And so when you look at fairness, if you take Oregon out of the equation, would there be, I mean, is there revenue there or not? Is there receipts from people who live here that are broadcasting in this income is, or these shows or these advertisements are coming into the state? Without Oregon viewers, would there be revenue? That's the but-for question that I would ask to see about fairness.
Senator Boquist.
Let me try a different approach to Senator Vance's. And you'll like this one.
Because all you have to do is say yes or no. The present law, right? What I guess the 83 does is extend present law and say, let's come back in 2 years and revisit this. Is there something wrong with present law, yes or no?
Chair, ask Senator Boquist. No, that's a policy decision.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Deanna.
Thank you.
You have nobody else signed up in this public hearing. I don't know if your team wants to come forward.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Patak with the motion.
Get seated first. It's okay.
Okay, thank you.
We're not in a rush.
Okay.
The clock's not running. Okay,
so
now
much.
Let's go.
Thumbs up.
This is Oregon.
Chairman Haas, Vice Chairman Benz, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Patak with the Motion Picture Association of America. We met just a few weeks ago, and there was a question from Senator Benz about the DOR's perspective on this issue, this important issue, and so we are back to answer any further questions. I think there are a few things. I'm accompanied by Aaron Solomon, who is tax principal with the Walt Disney Company, and Jeff Vesley, who is with the law firm of Pillsbury, and he's an expert on state tax issues. So I'm going to ask them to respond to some of the issues that were raised by Ms. Mack, and we're happy to answer any questions that you also have directed for us. Thank you. Aaron, do you want to?
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and Vice Chair Benz and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Solomon. I'm a tax principal at the Walt Disney Company. I'm here today on behalf of my company and the Motion Picture Association of America and its member companies, who are owners of all of the major television broadcast networks and most of the national cable program networks currently operating in the U.S. We strongly support Senate Bill 193, which continues the customer location method of apportioning the income of national broadcast companies and national cable program companies. I'm aware that you've already had one hearing on this bill, so I won't repeat that testimony here. I will briefly highlight the reasons to continue the customer location or commercial domicile apportionment methods for broadcasters. First, it is market broadcasting or market sourcing for broadcasters. Oregon enacted market sourcing for Oregon businesses in 2017. The customer location and apportionment method taxes broadcasters on their market, their customers, advertisers based in Oregon, and satellite operators, as well as local TV stations who license the programming made by the broadcasters. This apportionment method, which has been in the law since 2014, accurately reflects the way income is earned by the broadcasters. Second, it provides clarity and consistency to both the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue. Under customer location apportionment, the information about broadcasters' revenue is contained in their own books and records and does not rely on information that needs to be obtained by a third party, and in many instances is not available to the broadcasters. This apportionment method minimizes controversy by not looking through to the customers of the broadcasters' customers. Third, it is a modern method of taxing national companies. Customer location apportionment has been adopted by several states since Oregon adopted it in 2014. Rhode Island, Tennessee, Texas, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Kentucky. Other states have adopted it include Michigan, Illinois, and Florida. And it takes into account the direction in which the broadcast industry is moving, namely streaming directly to subscribers or over the top. I know you're familiar with our perspective on viewing the audience apportionment method. The broadcasters lack information about the audience, and it varies with each network. In short, it is not a settled matter, and it leads to contested audits and controversy. In addition, it is unfair to tax a company on the basis of the customers of its customer. In essence, the broadcasters can be analogized to wholesalers, the sales of which are apportioned based on customer location. Taxing national broadcasts and cable networks on behalf of their customers, advertisers, licensees, and direct subscribers creates a fair and rational system. For these reasons, I respectfully urge the committee to approve SB 193 and continue the customer location method of apportionment. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Let me just insert one thing. In the dash three, we are comfortable with your amendments, and we would urge the adoption of that dash three amendment. We're totally comfortable with extending it for 2 years. Two additional years, and deferring to a study that would be conducted by the LRO with the DOR. So we're perfectly satisfied with that.
Thank you.
Jeff.
Good morning, Chair Haas and Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey M. Vesely. I am a tax partner with law firm Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman. We are based in California, but a variety of states throughout the country as well as internationally. I am a state and local tax lawyer. I've been one for 40 years. Have direct experience in dealing with these issues here in Oregon, and thought I would add a couple of points that might be worth help you folks in trying to decide how to proceed. With respect to what is out there pending in court in Oregon, I think that you should be quite aware of this, and this gets to the extension of the time frame here. There are five principal issues that are pending in court cases in Oregon. One is whether the particular taxpayers have nexus. So Ms. Mack is correct on that point. Second point is whether the particular taxpayers have what's called an income-producing activity in the state. Third issue that's out there in the cases is whether or not a particular entity is an interstate broadcaster or not. And all of these cases are pre the customer domicile. So these are pre-2014. The fourth issue, which I think gets to Vice Chair Benz's question about what revenues should be looked at, a major issue that is out there pending is not applying just the audience factor to strictly interstate broadcasters, but also to all of their affiliated corporations within their consolidated return group. And that is a huge issue. And these might be particular entities that are engaged in such diverse activities as theme parks, could be also motion picture studios, could be merchandising, other things like that. The Department of Revenue is applying the audience factor to all of those activities, not just the ones that would be the interstate broadcaster or the potential interstate broadcaster. Those are all in court as we speak today. And I think that the other things that need to be kept in mind, Ms. Mack mentioned the Joyce rule. I would agree with her. Oregon is a Joyce state. But I think it's very important to understand what does that mean exactly. And it's in the Oregon statutes that you folks had passed many years ago. There's a statute that's 317, ORS 317.715, paren 3, and paren B as in boy. And it says in part that in the computation of the Oregon apportionment percentage for a corporation that is a member of an affiliated group of corporations, making a consolidated federal return or filing a consolidated Oregon return, for example, they may not be treated as a single taxpayer for purposes of determining the composition of the apportionment factor used to attribute income to the state. So what does that mean exactly? Well, what the department is doing is by applying the audience factor to the various other corporations in the consolidated return group who are not interstate broadcasters under anybody's definition, they are applying it as if it was one single taxpayer. And that is really a very contentious issue. Now, you may say, well, didn't the Comcast case take care of that in the Supreme Court? I think it must be kept in mind very clearly is the Comcast case was extremely narrow. I will read to you the language from the decision. It's at page 541 of the decision, which says exactly what the issue was in Comcast. The dispute between the parties in this court narrowly focuses on the question of what is included in the, quote, gross receipts from broadcasting, unquote, to which the Oregon audience ratio is applied. So it was very narrow. We had in the Supreme Court there, Comcast conceded they were an interstate broadcaster for purposes of that appeal. And the issue of whether or not you should apply the audience factor to theme parks or merchandising subsidiaries or anything else, who are all unitary. So they're all, and they're in the tax return themselves. That was not before the court in Comcast. That is before the tax court magistrate division as well as tax court regular court division right now. So to get to whether or not it would take some more time, it'd be good to take time to see how these cases play out. Absolutely. I think that the revenue estimates that were raised earlier, those are assessments, if I recall. Those are what are actually been assessed by the Department of Revenue. Those are not the final results. And a big portion of those numbers pertain to applying the audience factor to businesses that are not interstate broadcasters at all, but maybe theme parks, et cetera, things like that. So I think more time probably would be a great idea for you folks to do this. Will those litigations get resolved in 2 years? I wish I could tell you. I don't know, you know, but thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you about your home state, California. Is there an audience apportionment state?
Actually, what California does and has a special formula for, has a market-based sourcing formula there, has a single sales factor for most businesses. So it looks to the location of where the customers are. And that location of where the customers are is not an easy task sometimes, frankly. The commercial domicile point that we're talking about here, it is a method. And I think, as Ms. Mack said, it's as good a method. It's a good method, too. And I think it's trying to say where the audience is. I think a number of these companies, and Mr. Solomon alluded to this in his statement, is that these companies are like wholesalers, looking through to find the customer of the customer. For example, some of the entities would be dealing with the Comcast of the world, who have their own individual customers. That's who you go to if your cable's not working properly. You don't go to an ABC. You don't go and complain to them.
I was just wondering if you had the same problem in California.
Do we have the same problem in California?
Same kind of issues that we're talking about here.
No.
We do not, actually. No, I'm sorry, we don't.
And California does, to some extent, use audience. Remember, these companies are based there. And so by using audience, it's actually...
It works.
It's an advantage to use audience because the commercial domicile would source so much of the receipts to California. So audience is essentially somewhat favorable tax treatment for the home state industry. Is that the best way to describe it, Aaron? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that gets us nicely to one of the things that Ms. Mack raised, which was advertisers all leaving Oregon and moving to some other state. You know, California has all kinds of advertisers apparently within this space, so thus the audience method works better for those paying the tax. But just please humor me with my hypothetical of not having one advertiser left in this state. How do we get paid for or how do we tax you guys if there's no advertisers here? You're making money off us, the but-for test applies, so fill me in. What do we do as these advertisers leave or change domicile?
I'll start, but I'll defer to the experts. So certainly one way is the over-the-top, and that is the direction we're moving in, and that's essentially why commercial domicile does work, because you have an address of a subscriber. We have CBS All Access, HBO Go, the Walt Disney Company is bringing a streaming service into the universe before the end of this year. And more, you know, Netflix, Amazon Prime, you know who those customers are. So should there be a day, which it's hard to anticipate that there wouldn't be some companies located here that are national concerns in Oregon that would do business with our companies. Oregon is protected under this customer location because you have subscribers here that will be directly doing business with these broadcast companies. Those receipts would always be sourced here.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, well, of course, that's the over-the-top component. I'm talking about the other component. Now that the advertisers aren't here, there's still activity, is there not? Under the hypothetical, there's still audience share that's not being picked up in that segment you just mentioned. How do we end up having folks who generate income from that part of our population pay? How do we recognize that income?
So you're getting that income because those individuals, those households, so that audience may be subscribing to a cable company that licenses the program, and then they're having to recognize receipts here in California, whether it's Comcast, Spectrum, Verizon, those other AT&T, those companies, they are licensing the programming of the broadcasters, delivering it to their customers who are in Oregon. They are generating income, they being the cable operators and the satellite companies. So that's how that income sort of percolates to those entities and then is taxed here in Oregon.
Sorry for Mr. Chair. Sorry for trying to interrupt. I just like it sounded as though you were repeating what I just heard, so that's why I tried to interrupt. So forgive me. What I was talking about are the viewers that don't have any link to cable, aren't being billed individually. You know, there's still some people out there that actually use an antenna. So how do we pick up the income from them that you guys enjoy? How do we pick up that income if the advertisers are in New York?
So again, there's the three sources of revenue that you referred to earlier, the advertising, the licensing, and the over-the-top. If you're focused on just the advertising in your question, under a commercial domicile method, if there were no advertisers located here in Oregon, then there would be no revenue source to the state of Oregon. If market sourcing is based on where our customers are, right, that would be the method of sourcing. So if our customers were in, you know, California, Washington, New York, none of those sales would be sourced to Oregon under the commercial domicile method.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Right, and so therein is the issue, and I guess that's where the but-for test suggests you should pay, but you are not.
But we have no customers in the state. So I think you need to look at, or you might want to look at, the three revenue streams in total, right? So the over-the-top based on subscribers, the licensing based on where the cable operators are located. There are Oregon customers or Oregon businesses, so there would be sales sourced to the state.
And local TV stations.
And local TV stations, right, as well.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I think you mentioned you had five issues. You only listed four. What was the fifth issue? We had Nexus.
Right. Sorry, Senator Benz. Let me just double check my list here again. The Nexus issue.
That was the first.
Okay. The second issue is what's called the income producing activity issue.
Yeah.
Third is I know what I forgot to say. Third is the who is an interstate broadcaster who actually meets the definition, and the fourth is an issue. This is the one I neglected to say, is how do you measure the audience? And it gets back to the question of the use of the population ratio by the department. And again, these are issues that are pending in court where the department has taken the position that a population ratio should be used rather than some kind of a rating system or other type of audience things. That was the fourth. And the fifth was the revenues and applying it to all of the members of the consolidated return group.
Senator Riley.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just scanning through my iPad and noticed that I have NBC Sports, TNT, Netflix, Amazon Prime, and some others. And every one of those that I linked to when I signed up asked me what cable company I used. So that's the cable company, I assume, is who has my account. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I should add, if you don't mind, the agreements with the cable companies is between, say, the ESPN for Disney, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That contract is with the Comcast of the world. Comcast contracts with the individual subscribers. That's why I said earlier that if you got something wrong with your cable system, you're not going to Disney to get it fixed or ESPN like that. But you're absolutely correct.
Thank you. Senator Riley, now we know what you do on those long floor sessions.
Hey, got to have something. It's the only way I can get Trailblazer games down here.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
You okay?
He said his piece.
Well, we appreciate your input on this. For traveling up there.
Thank you very much.
We haven't devised a battle plan for this, and I don't know where the committee is. You can share with me if you'd like to go to this compromise amendment today, or we'll hold off on it.
Sure. I would rather hold off on it, just because I would like to understand completely what we just heard, and I don't. Yeah. And so, their indulgence, I would like to discuss it further and then get back to you.
So one of the things I've learned in these few years that I've been here is that the easiest way to kill something is to make sure it's complicated enough that we can't understand it, or at least tell us it is. I think that I'm ready to move whenever you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think there is a lot of, I think there was some new information, and there's still just a lot of digest, and really, truly one of the more complex areas that we'll touch on this year. So I'm okay with giving it some time to breathe.
Yeah.
So if that's okay with you all, we'll close this public hearing for now and bring this back in the future. So thank you. All right. On to a much easier concept. Federal taxable income and global intangible low tax income states. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 851. Caitlin, can you give us a summary on this measure?
Yes, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Senate Bill 851 requires, in addition to federal taxable income, the amounts deducted as global intangible low taxed income, or GILTI, as you may have heard it referred to. This bill currently applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. And I have a brief, simple presentation to try to illustrate some of these, some of this concept to the committee today. So before I begin, the purpose of this presentation is to illustrate that there may be a problem depending on how the state treats this GILTI income. So again, I'm trying to provide this simple overview. I'm going to give a quick background slide and then detail the problem, but I want to kind of frame the conversation in terms of this problem. So I'll provide an overview of what is GILTI income. Some key terms here. So the first, for this background information, is dividends received deduction. This is often referred to as a DRD within the state. These are dividends that are issued from one company to another, and in the context of this discussion, one of these companies is located abroad. At the federal level, they receive dividends of this type receive 100% deduction. Within Oregon, we currently require an add back of that federal amount in most cases, and a state level 80% deduction. GILTI, which is on the right-hand panel here, this is a new type of income that was created under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or TCJA. It's designed to recapture income from CFCs, or controlled foreign corporations, for taxation purposes. And within the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this GILTI income is eligible for a 50% deduction at the federal level. And so that brings us to the potential problem, which is that we could enter into a situation where a double deduction occurs. So the kind of big question here currently is, will Oregon treat GILTI as a deemed dividend? If not, then we only have this federal deduction, and so we're kind of okay. If the state does choose to treat GILTI as a deemed dividend, this is where the problem arises, because now we have a double deduction. So, again, trying to illustrate this is a potential issue depending on how the state will treat GILTI. But the bottom line here is that right now, so currently in the absence of legislation, there's some uncertainty for taxpayers on how to treat this income. And so this could be risky moving forward due to that uncertainty.
In the absence of legislation,
yes.
To clarify.
And so on this slide, what I'm going to do is just give you an example of the left-hand track here. So if there is a problem, what does it look like? So this example is if we allow this dividends received deduction at the state level. So if we start at the federal level and a taxpayer, for example, has gross, I'm calling this gross GILTI income, so this is the GILTI amount that would be included at the initial, when no deductions have been made. So let's say they have $100 of that. Under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they are provided a 50% deduction of that initial amount. So the deduction would be equal to $50. And so what I'm referring to as the net guilty amount would be that initial 100 gross amount minus the 50% deduction. So we're left with net guilty of $50. And that's at the federal level. So when we get to Oregon's case, the net guilty amount will be included in federal taxable income based on our tie to the federal form and federal taxable income. And so that means that the Oregon taxpayer begins with, in this simple case, $50 of federal taxable income, because that was the net amount or the bottom line under the federal level. So the problem arises when we look at this dividends received deduction. So in Oregon, in general, we give 80% deduction for these types of dividends. So if the taxpayer were to, for example, take 80% of the gross guilty amount, which was the first line under federal level, so 80% of that $100 of guilty income would give them a deduction of $80. And so then if we take their federal taxable income, which was the $50, the net amount, and we allow an $80 deduction, now we have a negative number at the end. And so herein is where the problem arises. Again, this is a simplified case with only one type of income, but I'm trying to use this to illustrate that there's the potential for a problem and there's uncertainty surrounding this issue currently in the absence of legislation. So that's all I had for the presentation.
Thank you, but this sounds eerily familiar because of what we passed a year ago to try and prevent a double deduction. Mm-hmm. But is this the same, or is this a different potential double deduction problem?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, it's a different potential double deduction problem. So my understanding is that last year, the problem that was addressed previously was the transition tax, which was a one-time kind of recapturing of this income. Guilty is an ongoing, under the current law, an ongoing way of addressing this. So it's similar problem in concept, but different parts of the IRC or of the tax code.
Questions of Caitlin?
Do we have witnesses?
We do have some.
Do we have any witnesses that you and I previously talked about?
I have Nikki Dubai here. Are you willing to come up? Would you like to come up? And Jeff Newgard is on deck.
Nikki? Senator Haas, members of the committee, I did not prepare a statement today. I'm happy to answer any questions. And Nikki DeWay on behalf of COST, we are not taking a position on this bill currently. We are of the camp that we don't believe there is an issue because at the federal level, guilty is not a deemed dividend. If the Department of Revenue were to determine that it was going to treat guilty as a deemed dividend, then we would potentially have this double deduction problem. But as things stand as of today, we don't see an issue with current law. Our general position is that we encourage decoupling completely from guilty. As I said in my written comments, we know Oregon is a bit situated a bit differently based on our history with several other provisions. So we are happy to be a resource. We've been dealing with this issue in many other states. So I can explain to you what's going on in some of the other states, how they're treating it. But that's I didn't have any prepared comments otherwise today.
I just saw your testimony.
Yeah.
In the
system. But happy to answer questions. We've been working on this issue a lot.
It sounds like a lot of people share your interpretation that there's not a problem, but there are others who don't share that interpretation and therefore might take advantage of this.
Senator Haas, what we have seen some happen in at least three other states. So currently there are 13 states that conform to guilty. In three of those states, we have seen the departments of revenue in those states say, we are going to treat guilty as we have previously treated subpart F income, which in Oregon we treat as a deemed dividend. And then under 317-267, if something is a deemed dividend, then that is when it's subject to the 80% Oregon DRD. So up to this point, we don't have any guidance from the department. And so we do not believe that 317-267 currently applies.
Okay. Questions of Nikki Dubai while she's here? Senator Benz?
So the original, am I correct in recalling that this was, the idea was to tempt the money back in to the United States? That was the original underlying strategy here, wasn't it? I was trying to remember. I haven't read about this since they passed this thing a year and a half ago.
Senator Haas, Senator Benz, are you referring to the transition tax, so the true deemed repatriation that happened in 2017, or GILTI?
Probably the former, but tell me, you know, to the extent that you might know, the reason for this structure.
For GILTI?
Yeah.
Senator Haas, Senator Benz. So with the TCJA, the federal government went from what we know, what is referred to as a worldwide system, meaning that they taxed a U.S. taxpayer's worldwide income, to a territorial system. And so now for a U.S. taxpayer, only their U.S. Income is subject to U.S. income tax. To discourage base erosion and profit shifting, or companies sending money offshore, they created this concept of GILTI. And so this global intangible low-taxed income. And how this works at the federal level is they now include in the U.S. taxpayer's corporate tax base all of the foreign income. It's not just limited to intangible income, so all of their foreign income based on a certain ratio related to tangible property that is held in a foreign country. That's the GILTI amount. And then at the federal level, they provide a 50% deduction. And then they allow an 80% foreign tax credit to offset that amount at the federal level. The states don't conform to the foreign tax credit. So where the states come in is at that tax base amount. And, you know, a question in many states is whether they pick up this gross amount, whether they add that back, or they add back the net amount, which is after the 50% deduction. So again, at the federal level, this was all part of a very large package, with the purpose being we needed to lower the federal corporate income tax rate. In order to do that, and the specific numbers are in my testimony, they had to come up with about $684 billion. And to do that, they needed to broaden the base. And GILTI was, I believe, the third largest base broadener at the federal level. So that's the intent. It's also is intended to, you know, discourage companies from shifting profits offshore.
Thank you. Jeff.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Newgard, and I'm representing the Smart Growth Coalition. We don't have prepared comments either outside of the written testimony that's on OLIS. The one comment that I would like to make is that the comments on OLIS are specifically referring to the language in the original bill. And if the intent is to apply the Oregon DRD to the GILTI income, that the reference to GILTI should be in subsection 2 of ORS 317-267?
Correct.
So we're happy to work with the committee and provide any feedback that you guys might be looking for.
Well, I think the, you know, I'm grossly oversimplifying the legislation, but just, you know, clarification that this double deduction is not allowed is really what we're looking for. Now, I don't know how this legislation also connects to something else, but you're not opposed to that.
No, Senator Haas, we don't. Yes, we would not support double deductions. Yeah. That's not what our members are out for. And I would encourage the committee. This is a policy decision as to how you treat this. We are seeing different states do different things. We're seeing them decouple. We're seeing them include it as into their corporate income tax base, and we're seeing them treat it as they previously treated subpart F or as a deemed dividend, and then providing a state DRD. So clarifying which direction you want to go would be incredibly helpful for taxpayers. There's a lot of confusion in this area. The more clarity you can provide in statute would be very helpful. We'd also encourage you, if you decide that as a policy matter, you would like the state to apply a state-level DRD, we would encourage you very much to do that in statute, as opposed to just having the department have to provide guidance, because they can always change their position, and it's better when we have things just clearly in statute. We can avoid all those that litigation that Jeff was talking about.
We concur.
Not this Jeff, sorry.
Jeff Fesley.
I'm just going back to which I asked the question before, and it, I think, escaped. We got into, I think, a unanimous vote on 1529, which is what started, and there were two topics in 1520 we talked, was the initial repatriation, and then it was the next step was the future repatriation of these funds as we change this. And I'm just kind of reaching out here because we had these conversations. I know that the present vice chair in the House was not involved, but you and I were in conference calls about this, and they seemed to think that GILTI was straightforward and it was fine the way it is. Do we know that there's now a group of entities that are saying, okay, we're not sure whether it's the DRD or whether it's the federal connection, and that's what we're trying to resolve here? I mean, is it the ambiguity that we don't know what the Department of Revenue is going to do? Because we were in conference calls on this particular issue, and we asked at that time, do we fix GILTI at that time? And everybody that was involved in those discussions thought it was pretty well straightforward. And it sounds like it's pretty well straightforward, but notwithstanding, DOR takes a different position. And is that what we're trying to fix here?
So, Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, Chris might be able to provide more detailed information on the conversations that happened when I wasn't here. And I believe, and maybe Nikki would have more detailed information on this, but I believe that states are treating this in different ways. And so some states are treating this as a deemed dividend, and other states are treating it in a different way. So my understanding of the fact that there's kind of these different approaches by different states is that it's not as straightforward as it would be if statute were to clearly state it's this or this.
Senator Boquist.
So without naming names, what I'm trying to drive at here is we had fairly significant payees of 1529 on conference calls, in which we had discussions that they thought the GILTI was rather straightforward. It was the federal portion of it. So are we, if that group of taxpayers, the group of massive group that's paying for this anyway, if they're not going to sue us and we're going to apply it, the GILTI under your model first, answer no, I think, then there's not a problem. Or are we saying that, okay, now there is confusion and they're worried that the Department of Revenue is now going to do something different, and we need to have a clarity whether it's the yes or no on your screen. That's what I'm trying to drive at. I mean, we talked about this at 1529 as the run-up to 1529. Is okay, mm-hmm. If we're going to fix it the one time, do we fix the GILTI at this time? And everybody in the industry seemed to think that, no, it was fine, and it was pretty straightforward. But, of course, full employment for lawyers could be different. So I'm just trying to figure out what it is we're trying to fix. And if their position has changed, or DOR has been talking and saying, no, we need to have clarification. I'm not opposed to either one. I'm just trying to figure out what it is for.
Well, thank you both for coming by. We've got the Department of Revenue standing by. Nikki, thanks for coming up. Unprepared. You seem pretty prepared.
I talk about it a lot.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And just to really talk about the issue at a fairly high level, when we worked on Senate Bill 1529, we were really focused on the one-time repatriation and how Oregon law interacted with the listed jurisdiction, what you guys call the tax haven laws, and those, some of that income had been already added back to returns, and so we had to deal with subtraction or credit, or how do we deal with that situation. The territorial taxation and the GILTI FDII issue really was deferred. We didn't really deal with it, Senator Boqvist, in 1529. There may have been conversations I was not a part of.
You were not.
Yeah, I was not. But we did not, we didn't actually deal with that in 1529. This bill, the reason that there's confusion, I think, is that there is a camp of folks like Nikki, Dobe, and Cost today that is, you know, under current law, they think that there isn't a problem. There's another camp that thinks, gosh, there is a problem because there's other states are doing things differently. Under IRC 245A, the territorial taxation is we think, provided for it. They call it a dividend. And so then it becomes a question of is the income that is coming into Oregon, because it's coming from a CFC, a controlled foreign corporation, much the same as the subpart F income that we do by rule say is a deemed dividend. It's coming from the same source. And so it's likely, we have not done this evaluation yet, but there are other states that have. It is likely that we would have the same outcome. And if that was the case, then there would be a potential double deduction because of the deemed dividend of the GILTI. And so that's where clarity, when you have, I think anytime you can add clarity to the statute, we would be grateful, because there is two very intelligent camps of people that have differing opinions about it. And that to me is the definition of ambiguity. So if we can get clarity from you on what your policy choice is, because we can do either, that would be fabulous. But I'm basically echoing, I think, what Nikki just said about the potential ambiguity, and clarity would be helpful.
Thank you. This adds, and when you look at the legislation, it adds seven words.
I actually don't think I have the bill in front of me.
Could you be kind enough to put your slides back up there?
Yes. Isaac, can you put them back up for me? Thank you. Yes, which slide?
Go to the yes, no ones. Okay, yes, no, right there. So if I understand what we're talking about, Ms. Mack, mm-hmm. is your, if we look at this slide here, your analysis or your theoretical presentation, because you haven't made a determination yet, is likely to fall into the yes category, and therefore there might be a problem, and we need to decide whether we want to fix the yes or go with the no. Right. Follow up then to staff. Okay, what does the bill say, yes or no? Because there's only seven words.
Or deducted as global and global low taxes.
Right, so is the bill say we're going to do no, or does the bill say we're going to do yes and some fix?
Chair House, Senator Boqvist, I think the intent of the bill is to avoid a double deduction. So I believe the intent is to say, if you're treating this as yes, you don't get the second deduction. There are language issues currently with the bill that we're working on. So
for clarity, and then both of you can answer because Ms. Mack wants to answer too. So what I understand is the intent of the bill, the way it is right now, is to establish the no category on the right-hand side.
Chair Haas, Senator Boqvist, so my understanding of the bill, the intent is, and maybe this is, Deanna, would you like to answer?
Senator Haas, or Chair Haas and Senator Boqvist, the way I read this bill is in section one, it's saying there shall be added to federal taxable income the amount deducted as globally taxed, the GILTI deduction, so that's the 50%. So what would I think would happen is that you have the income reported, the federal 50% deduction would not be allowed, but the Oregon 80% dividends received deduction would. So you'd have a different outcome. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so
but that's exactly opposite of what I think by looking at the bill.
See,
that's why I'm...
there's actually kind of a third option in here, really, if you think about it, because you could do what you just said and just say the Oregon 80% doesn't apply and they just get the 50% federal deduction and leave it at that, just not allow a deemed a dividends received deduction under Oregon law. And I think that's what you were saying with the no.
So, if I could add something to what Deanna said, I believe the bill as written doesn't put us into a yes or a no, and there are language issues there.
Flip to your next sheet and explain to us what it does do then.
So, what the bill does as written, Chair Haas, Senator Boquist. What the bill does as written is it takes away, there we go. It says add back this deduction here. So you take the 50 and you add it back.
Right.
What the bill does not do as written, in my understanding, is tell us if you should be a yes or a no here. So it's saying if you are a yes, add the $50 back. But I'm not sure that it answers. So your initial question, are we yes or no based on the bill? If, as written, it doesn't address so
you're,
that question.
You're advocating a more clear way to clarify this issue.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what the problem is in solving. If the bill right now basically says we're going back to yes or no, but we don't have a solution. That's what the bill says right now. And that what I'm getting here is like, oh, we're going to add it back, but now we don't know what to do with it.
Senator Riley.
So it seems the bill is, as it seems we're hearing right now, and I don't know because I couldn't quite figure it out myself, but from what I'm hearing is that we're saying take that $50 deduction away, so now we're looking at $100, and we're going to apply our 80% deduction. Is that how you read the bill as it's written?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, that would be how I would read the bill, and especially if our rule, if we write a rule that says that this income is a deemed dividend. So it would be better if you just said in the statute whether it was a dividend or not.
Sure.
Remember when we were doing the broadcaster's bill, how easy that was?
I remind you about Joyce and Finnegan. It's
okay.
All fun.
Sure. I'm just pointing out that, okay, if we're going step, and I'm with Senator Riley here, we're going to add it back. But the question is we're not adding any clarity. What do you do with it now? And now you're just the free enterprise lawsuit.
Just said list it as a dividend.
Right, which I'll tell you right now, there's probably people who are going to go in the courtroom and we'll lose whatever we have here. I mean.
Okay, we'll take another swing at this bill. It's just a public hearing today, so appreciate the discussion.
Thank you.
Jeff and Nikki for coming down, and Deanna.
And we'll close out the public hearing on that bill. Thank you, committee, today on these two thorny issues. And this is fun. We will be back next week. We'll adjourn.